I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is poet George Vilgair. He's the Witter Binner Fellow at the Library of Congress. Well, let's see what else you're going to read to us.
Maybe something a little lighter. There is a character that keeps showing up in the newspaper. This guy's name is Steve Fawcett. I don't know if you've read about him, but he's out of St. Louis. He is a millionaire. And Steve Fawcett, his goal in life is to become the first man to single-handedly sail a balloon around the entire planet. He seems to try this about every 6 months or so, gets a lot of money together, and then embarks on this journey, and invariably fails spectacularly. And then he tries it again. And there's something about his indomitable spirit, the fact that he must do this, that compelled me to write this poem. And incidentally, if you ever read about him, he's always called Millionaire Steve Fawcett, as if that were his first name. So I am going to read a poem about this profoundly human quest. It's called, quite simply, Millionaire Steve Fawcett. I like to follow the exploits of Millionaire Steve Fawcett. In his efforts to become the first man to successfully circumnavigate the globe alone in a helium balloon. Every 6 months or so he gives it a try. There will be a photo of him standing in a field somewhere, surrounded by his little crew, giving a big thumbs up to the camera. There's always a huge, expensive-looking balloon behind him, and you start to get the feeling that Millionaire Steve Fawcett never goes anywhere without that balloon. A week or so later, there will be another photo. This time, he's standing in a field surrounded by Sherpas or Maasai warriors or a couple of heavy-set Kansas farmers who just got the scare of their lives when he came down on their wheat field, just missing the combine. They look more anxious about facing the press than the Maasai warriors do, who are used to being on National Geographic specials. They smile at Millionaire Steve Fawcett, who has his arms around them as he poses with his crumpled balloon in the background. Back to the old drawing board. A few months later, and he's standing in a rocky field in Iceland with his crumpled balloon, or floating somewhere in the Pacific, surrounded by a smiling Navy rescue team who have risked their lives to save him. There are those of you who would ask, why doesn't Millionaire Steve Fawcett give up this foolish quest, this vain striving, and join the common lot of us as we struggle through the daily confusion, the dull quotidian of our lives? And besides, what will it prove if he actually manages to fly the damn thing around the world? But Millionaire Steve Fawcett cannot hear your cries down there at ground level, where you stand being sensible and ordinary. Right now, he's too busy looking up into the immense cave of his balloon high over the Andes. His brow is furrowed. A little rent, a tear-shaped hole has appeared, and it looks like trouble. Somewhere, far below him, in a deep, inaccessible valley, an Andean shepherd and his sheep are about to get the surprise of their lives.
So, well, you should see what he feels about poets.
Yes, I don't want to hear. I'm afraid I'll hear from him after this show. And
balloon around the world, some people think that what we're doing is much more madness.
You're absolutely right. I mean, when you think about all the effort and struggle, when you were talking about these poetry contests, all of the effort, all of the sweat, blood, and tears that goes into this, and how small the financial rewards are, because they are small. It is. One of the things that attracts me to it is that it is a very pure pursuit. You know, you're not writing a potboiler novel that's going to make you $50,000 and get you on Oprah. It's a very humble craft, and there's nothing to get
from it. But at the same time, it is a world where much striving and everything in that world is as political as the White House. I mean, it's very interesting. It's a microcosm, for sure.
Absolutely.
But at the heart of it, it is who said to get things right.
Mm-hmm.
Who said just to get something right on the page. You were going through this divorce. Mm-hmm. I bet your life was totally scattered. So many of our days are completely flying away from us. But if you can get one thing on the page.
That's right. That's good.
That's right. Well, it will stay there.
You know, yes, I always think of a photograph I saw in Life magazine years ago when Bobby Fischer was playing for the World Chess Championships in Reykjavik. And they did a feature on Bobby Fischer in Reykjavik, and they ran a big black and white photograph of his bedroom. And, you know, Fischer was notoriously excessive and unruly and out of control, and the bedroom was an absolute wreck. I mean, the bed was unmade, his clothes were all over the floor, there were, you know, chicken bones on the table, just total chaos, except in one little corner under a brilliant little lamp was the chess table and the chessboard, perfect order, untouched by the madness of the world around him. And I think we all need a place where we can go and create order and serenity and space for ourselves.
That is a perfect illustration for poetry.
I should write a poem about that. Maybe
you
I'll
did.
Do that right now.
You just did. I mean, that is, mm-hmm. I think, a needed poem because it's exactly what we're doing. We're creating one little clarity. Who said clarity out of chaos? I'm always wanting to say Wallace Stevens, but I'm not sure he did.
It sounds like something he would have said.
Well, he should have, anyway. And reason enough to go on.
Yeah, very much so. And
we're at the Library of Congress going on and on, and we love it here because George Bilger is our new fellow for 1 year under the aegis of Billy Collins, who is our United States Poet Laureate. And he chooses two fellows this year. Each laureate gets a chance to choose two Witherbinner fellows, two people that he believes in so much and feels that he can invest the future of poetry comfortably in these two people and endorse them. That's what it amounts to. So George Bilger was chosen and Katia Kapovich, and these are our fellows for the year.
And I have to say that one of the big thrills of last summer I went back to Santa Cruz for the past month of the summer. I had entered this contest, the Akron Poetry Prize. I had no idea who the judge would be. And, of course, I had small expectation of winning. And I was spending the summer working, and one afternoon I was walking. I was actually going to go down to the beach, and I was walking through the living room, and the phone rang. My sister picked it up and said, "It's for you." And someone on the other end said, "Hi, George, it's Billy Collins, the Poet Laureate." And I thought, what?
You know, he must get a kick out of making such a call,
exactly.
too, as
thought,
much as you get out of getting it.
What could be more fun than, first of all, actually being the laureate and then calling people? You know, it reminded me.
I have something to give you. I mean, how many times do you answer the phone and people have something that they want to give you rather than something they want from you?
A phone solicitor. No, I was tempted to hang up, think it was a practical joke, but no, it was great to hear from him.
Give us more.
I worked last summer at I spent some time writing in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm from St. Louis. Grew up in California, went back to St. Louis as a graduate student, and still have some friends there and family. And so I spent part of the summer writing there on the campus of the university. And every day I did the same thing. I sat down in this room and worked. And I noticed that every day this fellow, this custodian, the janitor on the campus, followed his own similar pattern. And I don't know if you know St. Louis, on the opposite side of the Mississippi from St. Louis is East St. Louis, which is one of the most one of the poorest, most depressed cities in the country. I think it's important to know that for the poem. Here's the poem about just watching this fellow at his job. It's called Janitorial. All morning he drifts the spacious lawns like a gleaner, picking up this and that, the summer clouds immense and building toward afternoon, when the heat drives him under the shade of the oak trees in the quad, and then along the cool corridors inside to pull down last term's flyers for the chamber recital, the poetry reading, the lecture on the ethics of cloning, the dinner with some ambassador, the debate between Kant and Heidegger, the frat party, the sorority party, the kegger, the weekend Bergman Festival, the Wednesday screening of Dumb and Dumber. He says hello to fine young ladies and tries not to dwell on their halter tops, their tanned thighs, shorts up to here. At 5 o'clock, he climbs into an old, dumpster-colored Oldsmobile, lights up and heads home across the barge-ridden river in its servitude to East St. Louis, where you know this poem, glib, well-meaning, trivial, grows tongue-tied and cannot follow.
I don't remember that from the manuscript.
Yeah, this is new. This is from the next manuscript.
Thank you, because I was priding myself in knowing all of your work.
You are so good.
This is a yet to come book.
This is something I'm working on.
And what is the
now.
Title of that book?
This is going to be called Haywire.
For what reason?
One of the poems in it was called Haywire. And as I gathered all the work together, I realized that it seemed to me that in this collection, I kept going back to my youth in the 1960s, and that thematically, the poem seemed to be about a time when everything was falling apart, when there was chaos, you know, Vietnam, the beginnings of the civil rights movement, my own parents' divorce. So many things were coming apart at that time. So many things that shaped me and shaped my generation, that I found myself going back in poem after poem to that time. I'll read the title poem from it. I love the word haywire. You know, you cut the wire around a bale of hay and it just goes crazy in all directions. And it seemed just right for this poem. And I also touch on something else that was true in those days and I don't think is any longer. Back in those days, I think it was much more common for grandparents to live with their kids. Certainly my friends, it seemed that so many of my friends had grandparents living with them or a surviving grandparent. And that seems so much rarer today, you know, so this kind of goes back to that. It's called Haywire. When I was a kid, there was always someone old living with my friends, a small gray person from another century, who stayed in a back room with a Bible and a bed with silver rails. They were from a time before the time the world just plain went haywire. And even though nothing made sense to them anymore, they'd gotten used to it and walked around smiling vaguely at the aliens ruining the galaxy on the color console television, or the British invasion growing from the sides of our heads in little transistorized boxes. In the front room, by tube glare, we were just starting to get stoned, and the girls were letting us help them out of their clothes, while in the back room, someone very tired closed her eyes and watched a wheat field where a boy whose name she can't remember is walking along a dusty road, no sound but the sound of crickets, no headlights in the distance yet.
Ouch.
So that's...
I love it. You did it again. Oh.
But yeah, I mean, imagine...
You keep doing that.
Those people, my grandmother was from a time when, you know, I mean, it's a world that I can no longer imagine.
Who was your nanny?
My nanny was my parents were sort of well-to-do in St. Louis when I was a kid. She was a woman from a small Missouri town who was hired to look after us. Mm-hmm. As, you know, my father worked, my mother was sort of out on the social circuit. She was a wonderful woman named Velma who died last year.
You had a bittersweet moment with her in a poem because it was almost as if she, I thought she might have been your grandmother. She was taking the place of something badly needed in this poem. It wasn't.
She did.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly. It wasn't a delightful moment. It was, I thought, a very painful thing.
Yeah, she stood for a. My parents weren't very much in evidence when I was a kid. They were out. They were away most of the time, and she sort of raised us.
We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is poet George Vilgaire.
The poem is called Childhood. While the needle traversed air, falling from its little height to land in music, we were alone, speechless in the tired light. Her eyes were closed, her hand on her heart. Art was the highest drama. With a flurry of violins, the voice poured into the room, sweet, nearly unbearable. Puccini. Someone had died, would never be forgotten. We were proof, submerged in that fantastic sauce, drowning the whole room, painting even the dull light gold until the song died. Time for dinner. From the black mouth of the oven came her meatloaf, thick brown slabs we ate in silence. Now, that was pretty gloomy, you've got to admit.
So indigestible. But, you know the best line in that poem?
What?
What do you think it is?
I kind of like the fantastic sauce now that I think about Puccini, but...
The best line? No, you don't know. I told you I would tell you.
All right, tell me, because that's why I'm here.
Someone had died.
Yeah.
You know, that is a terrific line to do after you bring us the high flourish of Puccini. I never would have thought of that.
Because it's
from a child's
thing.
Point of view, that's the clear fact of it. And that is where the poem turns.
Right. And what does it really mean to you when you're a kid? You know it's a terrible thing, but you're not quite sure why.
Also, in that poem, we get the idea that so much is dying around you all the time. Even the meatloaf doesn't taste very good. Things are not exactly comfortable.
No. And I think, now that book was written in 94.
That was your first.
It was my first book. And I really feel, I mean, I look at the book now, but it's already been, God, it's been 8 years. And I like many of those poems, but, you know, I find myself thinking that's not probably how I do it now. For some reason, I feel the necessity of bringing in more of myself now, because to me the world is essentially it's a tragic place, it's a very funny place, and I want there to be space in my poems for humor. I think that's one of the reasons why I was so delighted that Billy Collins picked that manuscript.
Right.
Because
he's
the master of leading you in, and you think this is going to be a kind of light little fun souffle, and then boom. You know, he's taken you by surprise, and then he kind of waltzes off stage smiling. You know, he's so deft.
It's what he wants to do.
Yeah.
That's his quest.
Mm-hmm.
However, in your first book, I saw everything about you already.
You were telling me that.
And
what do you
all
mean?
The germs and gems were there. All the tones were there. All the story that you would be always telling started to be there. And there's not a poem to be ashamed of in that first book, even though people always say that about their first book.
No.
All of the things that are in the latest book are in your first book.
It's a story I keep retelling. And I'd like to read you a poem that I didn't write. It's the poem that the going begins with. It's a few lines from a poem by Lisa Mueller.
Mm.
The poem is called Why We Tell Stories. And I remember coming across these half dozen lines and thinking, that is absolutely right. I have to use it as the epigraph for the book. She says this: why we tell stories? Because the story of our life becomes our life.
Mm.
Because each of us tells the same story, but tells it differently, and none of us tells it the same way twice. So, yes, I tell the same story, but you rework it.
But it's the craft.
Mm-hmm.
The craft was in the first book.
Yeah.
The care and the exactitude was, you've never faltered from that. You started out with a certain standard, and you kept it up. And I see it now, and I'll be very interested in the fourth book, Haywire, to see
me
where
too.
You're going. How far into it are you?
I want to finish it up this summer. And send it out. I would hope maybe even by the end of the spring I'll have something in shape that I can, you know, inflict upon the presses. So we'll see.
George Bulgair, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We'll have more poetry. We should go back to The Good Kiss.
Yeah, why don't I take something from The Good Kiss? I could read The Good Kiss, but you want me to read the title poem? Okay, why don't I do that? This is the title poem from the new book, The Good Kiss. And then there was the night, long after my wife had left me and taken on the world-destroying fact of a lover, and the city roared in flames with it outside my window, I brought home a nice woman who had listened to me chant my epic woe for 3 consecutive nights of epic drinking, both of us holding on to the bar's darkly flowing river of swirling grain as my own misery flowed past and joined the tributary of hers, our murmured consolations entwining in precisely the same recitative, the same duet that has been sung in dark caves of drink since the beginning of despair, the song going on until there was nothing for it but to drive through an early summer thunderstorm in the windy night to my little east side apartment and gently take off her clothes and lay her down on my bed by the light of a single candle and the lightning and kiss her for a long time in gratitude and then desire and then gently kiss the full moons of her breasts, which I discovered by candlelight were not hers exactly. Under each of them was the saddest, tenderest little smile of a scar, like 2 sad smiles of apology. I had them done so he wouldn't leave, she said, but in the end he left anyway, her breasts standing like 2 cold cathedrals in the light of the flaming city, and my lips touched the little wounds he had left her, as if a kiss, a good kiss, could heal them. And I kissed the nipples he had left behind until they smoldered like the ashes of a campfire the posse finds days after the fugitive has slept there and moved on, drawn by the beautiful and terrible light of the distant city.
That will be out when?
October of 2002, so it's coming up in 6 months or so.
Let's hear some more.
Okay.
What is this little pile?
These were a few things on the lighter side. One of them is, I guess, kind of a funny poem. What do you think at this point? Something light, something dark, something in between.
You have both in each poem.
Yeah, I've got both in each. Let's see, why don't I do this? It's kind of a funny narrative poem. When I wrote The Good Kiss, I did something that I had never done before. As a writer, I think writers tend to be superstitious about how they write. You know, everything has to be the same each time, the same pen, the same kind of ink, the same, I don't know, lucky sweatshirt. You know what I mean? Most people are very ritualistic about it. And I was the same way. I always wanted to write in a library. I liked being in a library because there were people around, but it wasn't intrusive. But the summer I was writing this manuscript, I had just gotten divorced. I really didn't want to be by myself, cooped up in a library. So I started writing in cafes in Santa Cruz, California. There was a little cafe that somehow seemed just right. It was dark, gloomy, but the waitresses were friendly. And I would go there in the morning, get a cup of coffee, and I would work the morning there. And I really found that helpful. Sometimes change is good. Well, one of the things I noticed at this cafe, and this is true in lots of places, is that local artists would exhibit their work there on the wall, you know, paintings, photographs, you know, for a week or so, and then there'd be another show. And I became very interested in these shows because as the weeks go by, I would see them come and go. Here's a poem that is in some way inspired by that. The poem is called A Little Grunt of Pleasure. It's clear that the photographer whose work hangs from the walls of this little cafe could tell you a thing or two about human misery. Probably she's been just as miserable as the people she's recorded in their misery and hunger and discomfort. The natives of foreign lands who look down on us like saints from their black and white enlargements, from a parched field in Sierra Leone, a squalid street corner in Calcutta, or a frozen village somewhere in the Andes. As we drink our lattes and fiddle with our cell phones, an old woman displays her gums and wrinkles in front of an old church somewhere miserable. A couple of Andean kids hold dolls on a mountaintop next to a thoughtful-looking yak. Their photo would cost me $250, framed. the pretty girl with a jewel in the middle of her forehead holding a parrot in front of a crumbling temple goes for 300, and the smiling, toothless farmer ankle-deep in a rice paddy would set me back a whopping $650, probably more than he makes in a year. I try to imagine an adventurous photographer from one of those godforsaken places flying over here to Santa Cruz with a big, old-fashioned camera, a make I've never even heard of, to capture me in my native habitat, in my apartment at the corner of University Boulevard and Warrensville Road. She's worked so patiently to gain my trust that I hardly notice her clicking away as I sit watching a rerun of Law and Order in a T-shirt and a pair of gym shorts, caught in the process of consuming an entire family-sized bag of Doritos and nearly a quart of Diet Pepsi, my face wearing the blank expression of TV watchers everywhere. The Doritos I'd been looking forward to with pleasure all day as I taught my lit survey courses, so far exceeding my expectations that now and then I give a little grunt of pleasure while chewing them into that particular spicy orange paste that only the corrosive bite of highly carbonated soda pop can break down, thus clearing the palate for another mouthful of pure ranch-style satisfaction. And I see her returning to her remote, miserable, high-altitude village in the rain, somewhere on the other side of the world, and putting her photographs of me on the grimy walls of a miserable cafe, where people come to chew betel nuts and drink a strange-smelling liquid, much like our coffee, from tiny, beautifully painted cups, speaking in low voices about the monsoons and the recent rebel uprising, while a young girl with huge dark eyes and a haunting face cannot stop gazing at the photographs of the American man with his TV and his chips and bean dip. He is so beautiful and so strange in his home in his distant country that for a moment, despite the watchful eye of her toothless, miserable crone of a mother who never lets her out of her sight, she dreams of joining him on the sofa, lost with him in the mystery inhabits in his strange land, far beyond the seas and the mist-shrouded mountains of her fathers.
Let's use that as a final poem.
Okay.
Because
that's
it is fine. So you.
Okay.
It is so you.
All right.
Because we can either take that poem out and use the new one,
okay,
or keep it in because we have come to the end.
Whatever works best. Yeah, that would be fine, Grace.
What I remember when I read your work, that the Doritos stayed with me, so I want to keep that. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our poet has been Witherbinner Fellow George Bilguer. The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress is made possible by the Witherbinner Foundation for Poetry. It's produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Peter Allier. Post-production is by Michael Turpin of MET Studios. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
We thank the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C. for supporting this program. The views expressed on The Poet and the Poem do not represent the Humanities Council or other funders for this series.